Media talk from guardian.co.uk.
Here are the nominations. Answer Me This. Answer Me This podcast.com. Media Talk, The Route at Radio 2, guardian.co.uk. Nature's Voice podcasts for the RSPB website, of course. Rethink Daily, rethinkdaily.co.uk. And The Butchery Gar and the Prisoner, cliftondiocese.com. Pat the winners, please.
Okay. A beautifully crafted programme which told a compelling story and delivered a profound emotional impact. The goal goes to...
You didn't really expect us to beat the Budgie, did you? Especially one with God on its side. Yes, I'm Matt Wells, and welcome to your Sony Silver Award-winning Media Talk. Coming up...
I love going to work every morning. It's an absolute privilege.
Thrilled, ecstatic and delighted and absolutely euphoric.
This is the one that's going to be in the papers tomorrow. The Gold Award goes to Electric Radio Brixton's Daily Show.
And I want to dedicate this award to my granddaughter. She's now 7 months old, so I figure at least it's a long time before I'm going to get a call on my answer phone from Jonathan or Russell.
We hear from the winners and losers at this year's Sony Radio Academy Awards and discuss the implications for Andy Parfit and Mark Damaser after Radio 1 and Radio 4 are snubbed in almost every category. Also in the podcast...
Somebody's come along, spotted that market opportunity and capitalised on it. That was all public information that should have been out there, and the only thing that put value on it was the House of Commons' decision to suppress it.
After the Daily Telegraph dishes the dirt on MPs' expenses, we ask how checkbook journalism stacks up against the public interest and freedom of information. Plus...
My salary is £92,000.
£92,000. So you're paid nearly twice as much as a Member of Parliament.
The BBC's Carrie Gracie gets drawn into the expenses row. We ask why a journalist on £92,000 failed to realise that she should never become the story. And we look at the battle over the Evening Standard after the paper's former editor, Veronica Wadley, blasts its Pravda-style good news. All this and much, much more is coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. The saddest news this week, of course, has been the announcement of the split between... Peter Andre and Katie Price.
Oh, that, right.
But no matter. My panel this week are ready to step into the void and become the showbiz couple du jour. Stephen Brooke is Media Guardian's press and publishing correspondent. Are you ready for every detail of your life to be dissected by Heat magazine?
Well, I wondered this because I once went on a press tour of the Big Brother house and had a photograph and sent it to all my friends saying, watch on Channel 4 on Friday night because you might get a big surprise. They all believed it, including my parents who rang up from Australia. Very concerned indeed. So, yes, I'm ready.
Okay. John Plunkett is our radio correspondent. Have you shed a tear for Peter and Katie?
Yeah, I did ring Pete saying if he wanted to go out on Friday night to help him get over it, but he's not got back to me
yet.
No,
funnily enough. Okay, well, we'll get on with the Sonys and the week's radio news a little later, but we'll start this week with the story that's been dominating the front pages for the last 7 days.
Isn't it time to wake up and see what's going on in the country? Isn't it time for us to see ourselves as the rest of the country sees us? Isn't it time to stop the talking, stop the endless committees, and start showing some real leadership to deliver some real change? How can we bring about the change this country needs if we cannot change ourselves?
Hear, hear. Now, unless you've been living in a cave for the last week or so, you won't have been able to open a paper or switch on the TV or the radio without being bombarded by revelations about our less than right and certainly none too honourable members of Parliament. It seems from the coverage as if they're all profiteering on second homes, cleaning their moats and helipads, or claiming for chocolate chip cookies and bath plugs, all at the taxpayers' expense. The Daily Telegraph has been running front page splashes on the expense row after it paid upwards of £75,000 for the information that was due to be made public later in the summer. The Telegraph, whose circulation figures have been boosted by the expose, claims a public interest defence. But the question of checkbook journalism has again been raised by the whole affair. But while the Telegraph is getting all the credit, in fact, the release of all this salacious detail is down to the work of the campaigner Heather Brooke, who first put in a Freedom of Information request on MPs' expenses in 2004 and has been battling ever since. She came into the Media Talk studio earlier and says this is all a problem of Westminster's own making.
Obviously, I would have liked to have that story, but it was not going to be published exclusively to anybody in particular. I mean, it was meant to be for the public, and the House of Commons had announced back in May last year that that would all be available in October of 2008. So when they didn't publish that, the thing that they did by suppressing the information, they gave it a black market value. Now somebody's come along, spotted that market opportunity and capitalized on it. I can't say I particularly blame them because that was all public information that should have been out there. And the only thing that put value on it was the House of Commons' decision to suppress it.
It's an interesting argument that Heather Brooke makes there, Stephen, that the value for this only information only came about because of the repeated attempts by Parliament to stop it being published. What do you make of the fact that the Telegraph paid for it?
Well, we're assuming they're paid, and I think that we're probably right in assuming that. Checkbook journalism is a big problem in Fleet Street, and I think it infects newspapers in so many ways, and everyone is at it one way or the other. But I would defend the Telegraph for its action here because I think that what they've done has been fantastic journalism. It's really defined Will Lewis's editorship of that paper. And I think that the reason that they have paid, if they have, in fact, is wholly defensible. The big problems with checkbook journalism are in how it can warp and corrupt the information that a paper gets. So if you pay for an interview, you expect that the person is going to sex up their account of what it is you're interested in. The other big problem is that newspapers will then go mad with the information and give it a huge run. And obviously the Telegraph has done this, but the information has not been corrupted because it's data from a disk that was, you know, in Parliament, but the press and public didn't have access to it. So it wasn't sexed up. And the huge run has been more than justified by the reaction of everyone, media and the public alike, to the revelations.
The problem, I guess, though, John Plunkett, is that although, as Stephen Brooke says, that the information is raw data and can't be sexed up, it can be presented in a partial way. And even though we now have had details of the Tory party as well as Sinn Féin and Liberal Democrats and Labour to begin with, you know, only about, I guess, 50 or 60 or so MPs' expenses claims have been published. That still suggests there's a vast majority of MPs whose expenses claims stack up.
That's right, yes. Other parties haven't had the chance to go through it in detail and haven't had the access that the Telegraph has. And the Telegraph gave it legs by splashing with Labour on day one, Conservatives on day two, by which time they obviously had, a counter plan to answer some of the charges, and they knew what was coming up.
Sort of day three or four, wasn't it, really?
Then after them, it was the Lib Dems who were clearly of less interest to everyone. But
there is a school of thought that the Telegraph, a Conservative paper, has favoured the Conservatives in the way that it went after, I think, the Labour cabinet first, then Labour ministers, and then Sinn Féin on the Sunday, leaving the Tories to
and
next week.
And you sort of detected, sorry to interrupt, you sort of detected a change in their tone. I think they were smarting a bit from that accusation, and they have really, in the last few days, they've really gone for the Tories, haven't they?
Yes, but I mean, if I was in charge of a left-wing newspaper or a liberal newspaper and I got that disc, such as, you know, editing The Guardian.
One day, Stephen, yes. One day.
I just think, you know, we are here to hold the people in power to account. So, of course, we're going to go for the government first, and that's right and proper.
Well, it's interesting to hear the defence of, or the attack, rather, of MPs, which has been to say, oh, this is terrible, terrible for democracy. But, you know,
I just think this is democracy in action, because what can be more democratic than an angry electorate voting out, which I predict will be happening, MPs that they believe have failed them in a heinous way?
Yeah, well, absolutely. The MPs and indeed one or two peers did get, as you say, very angry this week. And there's an illustration of it, of course, on television in a rather interesting encounter that happened on the BBC News channel this week when news presenter Carrie Gracie tangled with Labour peer Lord Fuchs live on BBC News.
You're not at all sorry to interrupt me. You're quite happy to interrupt me because you do it constantly. Every time an MP or a politician comes on, you constantly harass them. You don't allow them to finish. And MPs are going around the country in their constituencies doing a great deal of work. You never focus on that. They paid £64,000. How much are you paid for coming on to television, harassing members of Parliament, harassing other people in this way? Could you tell me, how much are you being paid out of the licence fee?
My salary is...
Freedom of information. What is it?
My salary is £92,000.
£92,000. So you're paid nearly twice as much as a Member of Parliament to come on and talk nonsense.
Every single call I make from my own phone. I don't even make a personal call from the BBC because I understand what public sector money is about.
And my understanding is that John Humphreys is paid hundreds of thousands of pounds. Jeremy Paxman is paid nearly £1 million to come on television and sneer at democracy and undermine democracy.
John Plunkett, how much are you paid to come on this podcast and sneer at the audience?
Well, I think the point of issue here is not the salary I'm paid, but the fact that MPs have been fiddling their expenses, which maybe...
That's what she should have said.
Maybe might have been the right answer. That's right, yes. Yeah, so there's a terrible moment where she says, my salary, and you're urging her to say, no, don't say your salary, and then it spills out and the conversation takes
turn. It's not about salaries, it's about expenses.
I mean, if she'd been fiddling her expenses at the BBC, or if anyone, presumably they get disciplined or fired. Yet the fact she's paid what might be a lot of money in some people's eyes is no cause for her to apologise or leave her post, unlike what some of these MPs have been doing.
Yeah, perils of live broadcasting, isn't it, Stephen?
This isn't going to go away. I think this will die down. But when the Tories get in, as we know, they want to freeze or cut the licence fee. And I think that we'll be hearing that clip again. You know, Carrie Gracie will not be the only minor BBC News presenter earning £90,000+ a year. And I think that that's going to be used later on as an argument that the BBC is overpaid.
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, is that we all know that probably £92,000 for a middle-ranking BBC News presenter is, you know, compared to what the rest of them are on. You know, if she's on £92,000, then what of your Turnbulls and your Silvertons?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also, Tim Luckhurst is on Comet is Free today with a very interesting point. £92,000 is not the amount that the producers and the people who are actually, you know, Carrie Gracie's bosses and have to sort of order her about or instruct her are going to be earning. They're going to be earning half that. And this is weird sort of topsy-turvy structure at the BBC where the talking heads are getting a huge amount of money, whereas the people who are nominally in charge of them aren't.
Ditto here, probably. Anyway, it's interesting that we...
Well, aren't you your own boss, in effect, Matt,
Head of audio. I tell myself... I've ordered myself to take a pay cut this year, obviously. You can follow this story at guardian.co.uk/politics. And don't forget our Politics Weekly podcast, if you're into all of this. It ought to be pretty tasty this week, too. You're listening to Media Talk, still to come. We've got interviews with Chris Evans, Vanessa Feltz, and full analysis of this year's Sony Awards. And in true radio fashion, here's a big shout-out to some of our younger listeners, if we have any. You have until the 1st of June, that's about 3 weeks, to get your entries in for the Guardian's Student Media Awards. There are all sorts of categories, so whether you're a feature writer, a sports photographer, or a reporter on your student radio station, make sure you go to guardian.co.uk/studentmediaawards, all one word, to get your application in. Right, on with the show.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
It was the 2009 Sony Radio Academy Awards this week, to give the event its full title. The big story wasn't the fact, as you heard at the very top of the podcast, that we came second in our category, and nor was it that Neil Dr. Fox won a Lifetime Achievement Award. John Plunkett, you were on our table for the awards at the Grosvenor House Hotel. What do you think that BBC Radio Chief Tim Davies has been saying to Mark Danvers and Andy Parfit over the past few days?
Well, it was really tough, yeah. It's clearly been a very, very big news year, and you'd have expected BBC Radio 4 to pick up some awards in some of the big news categories. But they got a gold in the interview award, but they won no gold at all in any of the news categories. So today, John Humphreys, Evan Davies, Eddie Mayer, they all went home, as far as golds were concerned, which is the one everyone wants, empty-handed.
Yeah, Radio 4 won comedy, in which they were pretty much the only nominees, drama, which they were definitely the only nominees, so they couldn't lose that one. And as you say, they won the interview award as well, but none of the big news awards went to Radio 4, and none of the big music awards went to Radio 1.
In fact, Radio 1, yes, they got one gold award last year, which was Chris Moyles, and none this year.
He got a bronze, Chris Moyles.
He got a bronze, which you imagine is probably worse than getting nothing at all if you're Chris Moyles.
That's the coming award,
yes,
sounds like.
Silver's fine. We take silver, but bronze is not good. It did allow the Sun to call him third rate.
Which they would have loved.
There's a bit of history there, isn't there?
Just a little.
It makes you ask, you know, has Radio 4, has today, had such a bad year, or did the Sony judges get it wrong? Five Live Breakfast did very well, got two awards this year, but none for Today. So you know, where did Today go wrong?
I think Adrian Van Clever Clogs, whoever his name is, will be very pleased with the controller of Radio 5 Live with his haul. Radio 3 got Station of the Year, of course.
Yeah, for the first time in its history.
Yeah, I asked controller Roger Wright whether this was a vindication for so many years of being the bridesmaid but never the bride.
First time for Radio 3, and if I may say, it's about time, but thrilled just for all of my colleagues.
So what is it about this year that's made Radio 3 Station of the Year when other years you haven't got it?
You'll have to ask the judges that. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, a lot of what we do and have done in this last year are the absolute core values of Radio 3. You know, more than 50% of our music output's live music, that big commitment to new work, a hugely successful prom season in the middle of all of that, that can too easily be taken for granted, but great to be able to have this particular award and just recognising something that actually can be too easily taken for granted.
It's great news for this year, but with the decisions that are coming up, the cuts that have to be made, the calls on the licence fee from all sorts of quarters, do you think that Radio 3 can continue with its privileged position?
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting. Every time anybody talks about the license fee and, you know, privileged position, your words, not mine. Actually, what a lot of people do is simply not question the position of something like Radio 3, and indeed, you know, the rest of BBC Radio, because actually, if we remain distinctive and offer something distinctive that the marketplace would never provide, then I think that's a good justification.
Roger Wright there. Stephen Brooker, are you a Radio 3 fan?
More a classic FM man, I must say.
Well, you're not going to be friends with Roger Wright.
Well, you know, he's big enough to take it. But then I wonder, this little theme that John was talking about earlier about the judging and whether some of it's been a bit perverse, because, you know, I listen to the radio quite a bit, a lot of it through my mobile phone, and I've always found classic FM more listenable than Radio 3, although I do recognise the massive commitment it does have to live broadcasting, particularly the prom season, which is out of this world, no one else in the universe does undertakes a similar project. But you know, listening to the Today programme, I wouldn't say that it's had a worse year than it has, say, in the
previously,
preceding three or four when it has won awards. So I'm scratching my head a bit at these results.
All right. Well, Prison Radio did excellently, and lots have been written in The Guardian about that this week. So we'll pass over that one. Captive audience jokes, we've done those ones as well.
But what I thought was great about that was that the sort of joy and the benefit of radio that some of the more hardened professionals, I think, forget about due to the industry going through a very tough time, that award seemed to re-energize people a lot. And what are we all here for? And that was a perfect example of it.
Absolutely.
And I got the impression, I think, maybe unspoken, subliminal, I'm not sure, that some people in the radio industry aren't overly keen that the prison radio should actually be allowed to enter the Sonas, or people don't see it as real radio because clearly you can only hear it within the walls of Brixton Radio, so should it qualify?
Well, but that's an extremely defensive kind of way of seeing the world, isn't it? And that's just not the way that people listen to what used to be called radio. Vanessa Feltz, talking about big personalities, as we weren't, she won Radio Personality of the Year. Well-deserved, do you think?
Well, yes, I'm not a huge fan, but I saw Elizabeth Mahoney in the Guardian Radio Critic today said she was a fantastic phone-in host and very warm embracing and accessible. And, she's got a very loyal following out there. So,
absolutely. Well, in football parlance, she was over the moon.
Thrilled, ecstatic and delighted and absolutely euphoric and electrified and really just brilliant, actually.
So what makes a good radio show?
I think it's something that you don't know at the very beginning how it's going to end. I think it's something spontaneous so that you're led by your listener and you'll go down whatever interesting and bizarre and unexpected or heartbreaking or elating path that they may take you down. And I think it's an environment where people don't give you a sort of special radio diatribe. They talk to you as if you're a real person that they know. And then you have an actual conversation, and then that's really fantastic.
Is there something special about London, do you think, that makes it for you, I don't know, any kind of easier or more difficult?
I think there's something very special about London. I mean, London is absolutely throbbing and pulsating with all manner of excitement and undercurrents and chemistry, potential, conflict, violence, sexuality. We're the multicultural, multiracial relationship capital of the world. And the potential's absolutely gigantic, and the cosmopolitan view is unique. And we're told that we're no longer patriotic, but we are Londonophiles, and that's certainly true.
a throbbing and pulsating Vanessa Feltz.
That is what she's like on her show. She can talk the leg off a chair, and her riffs seem to go on for 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
But I think it's captivating, and I'm very pleased she's won, because I have listened to her on and off over the years, and I think it's great that she's got the recognition. And next stop, Radio 2, Vanessa.
Yeah, probably. Well, talking about Radio 2, I think, John, the ceremony itself, the really interesting story was that it was completely re-energized by the host, Chris Evans, after years and years of being done in a particular fashion by poor Gambaccini. Chris Evans really gave it a new vitality, I thought.
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah, I missed some of the quirks that Gambo used to come up with. He was a bit less safe, perhaps, than Evans. But yeah, I thought he was a safe pair of hands. And unfortunately, it's a famously long event.
Hey, he zipped through. I had more than a safe pair of hands. I thought he was very warm and engaging and funny.
I thought he was okay. The problem is, with 37 awards, you don't get a lot of time to ad lib or put in gags in between the between the awards themselves, and they still went home past 11 o'clock. So from the first pop of the champagne cork to the last gong, it was 4¾ hours.
Good
so
Lord.
It's a long do, but, you know,
getting under Oscars kind of time. It is, frame,
certainly.
Isn't it?
Well, I mean, he won a couple of the big gongs himself, didn't he? The Music Personality and Entertainment Programme Award.
Did he hand the gongs to himself? How'd that work?
He didn't really demonstrate much of either of those in his interview with me, actually. I asked him about a difficult 12 months at Radio 2, which saw the firing of controller Leslie Douglas over the Ross Brand affair, her replacement on an interim basis by Lewis Carney, and finally the appointment of Bob Shannon as the permanent replacement.
Well, this year has been fine because, you know, the dust has finally settled from last year. But the last 12 months, you know, it was stormy seas, to be honest. But Leslie had done so much good work and been so rock and roll for so many years. There was so much energy going on. And, you know, and obviously Lewis stepped into the breach for a while and was up for the job himself, but, you know, didn't get it, sadly. But we were fine. But we were fine because we had enough sort of in the bank, as it were. But we were having to make withdrawals as soon as Leslie left. Gladly, we got Bob just in time. So, but I think Bob's going to be great. I really do. He's a very straight guy. He's very back to basics. He's very, you know, pillars of the temple. And I'm really looking forward to working with him. I think, in fact, Leslie and Bob together would have been a brilliant combination.
How do you feel about that time? I mean, it was a very turbulent time. It was a bad time for radio, the critics say. Do you think radio can come out of it and re-establish, particularly BBC Radio, re-establish its reputation for trust with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bad time for radio from a trust point of view, but especially with the scandal that's going on with the MPs at the moment, I think people know when people are in the wrong, and they could see there was one mistake was made, you know, as far as Radio 2 was concerned, the Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand thing, you know, that mistake was made, and then there was this attempt by some people to cause an avalanche, you know, would this cause the avalanche, but there wasn't an avalanche to fall, you know, that's the great thing. And now, to be honest, it's all shored up and we're back on track again.
So congratulations on your awards. What makes a great radio presenter?
Sometimes it can be a huge ego. Sometimes it can be total modesty. Sometimes it can be almost invisibility. You know, it depends on the radio program. I think what makes a great presenter is somebody who has a look at the program they're presenting and cuts his cloth to fit it, really.
So do you approach your job differently now than you did 10, 15 years ago?
No, maybe 10 years ago, not 15 years ago. You know, when I started doing this, I took it very seriously. And then I had the best time. And then I started to have what I thought was the best time. Didn't have a very good time at all. And I'm doing what I love again as well as I can, you know, and I can't do any better than that. And, you know, if you work really hard, you do sort of reap the benefits. So I'm really enjoying it now.
Chris Evans, well, we'll leave the Sonys there for now. You can read more comment and analysis, plus find a list of the full winners at mediaguardian.co.uk. Just click on the radio tab. But perhaps we should leave the final word, maybe, to Dr. Fox, who closed the ceremony with this delightful bit of commercial radio jockery.
I love going to work every morning. It's an absolute privilege. And one thing that really, though, genuinely struck me tonight, coming up here, although there are tough times, there's a credit crunch and all the other bull that's going on, the one winner, genuine winner tonight here is radio. There's no doubt, because you come here year after year, we still make great programs, we still have a good time, we still deliver great news or have fun on the radio. Whatever we do it well. So please, can everyone be upstanding, grab a glass, and let's make a toast to radio, ladies and gentlemen.
All together now, and I mean you at home or listening on the train or on the bus and in the studio.
To radio!
Excellent. And podcast.
Now, we've got that out of the way. There are a few other radio stories around this week. John, why don't you start us off in our news in brief section this week with Five Live revamping its weekends?
Yes, I'm very excited about that. Yes, we've got Danny Baker coming on Saturday mornings, taking over from Eamon Holmes, who I think could probably run his course several years ago. and on Sundays, there's a new comedy format to be confirmed, fronted by Christian O'Connell, who you might know from Absolute Radio, formerly known as Virgin Radio.
Yeah.
So I think it's long overdue. So I'm, sadly, if you're an Adam and Joe fan, as I am, on Six Music on Saturday mornings, you might have your
But sorry, you can listen again, though, can't
I? I can listen again, yeah, thanks so to the wonders of digital radio.
So that's fine. So. But it does mean that 6:06 is dropped during the week.
Yes,
and they've dumped Lovejoy, and I don't know about Spoonie, but he seems to. They're certainly not saying much on presenters, are they?
That's right. All the 6:06 that sort of spread throughout the week like a virus have all been chopped. So it's going to be restricted to Saturday and Sunday with the presenters to be confirmed. But Tim Lovejoy may be a sort of ad hoc guest.
We're
presenter.
Talking to him about future projects. I think
that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's the phrase.
That's the phrase. Finally, a ruling on John Gaunt from Ofcom.
Yeah, that's right. He was. This is the conversation you might remember he had last year with a London councillor, when he ended up calling him a Nazi, a health Nazi, and an ignorant pig.
Yes,
and Ofcom said
TalkSport,
yeah. On TalkSport, which is the not the home of free speech, unlike John Gaunt's new employer, SunTalk. But Ofcom said he went a little bit too far, and they've censured him for him last week. But of course, Gaunt's already left. TalkSport.
They fired him
after that interview, yeah.
And he threatened to sue them, so we haven't really had an update on that now in the light of the Ofcom ruling.
Well, we'll see. Well, I think he'll find it difficult to... I think he was hoping that the ruling would be a bit less severe, but it was fairly clear, I think.
The transcript makes an interesting reading, certainly, which you can see on the Media Guardian website.
Right.
It's enlightening to see the whole thing in full.
Well, we'll leave you to click on that for the full... delight. And John, Ofcom has been busy this week with Gordon Ramsay and Channel 4.
Yes, Ramsay in trouble for swearing, which is, you thought Ofcom were a bit late in the game here, but the sheer intensity, that's Ofcom's words, of swearing in his Channel 4 show, Ramsay's Great British Nightmare.
How many Fs and the derivations there are?
I've just got my abacus here. 115. 115 in the first 40 minutes. And a lot of them actually weren't from Ramsay, but were from... the chef that was in this restaurant.
I see.
So I've actually been to the restaurant, and I said,
which restaurant?
I forget the name of it, but okay. I said, can I have a hamburger, please? He said, do you want fucks with that? So the guy is he's a serial swearer.
He's a serial.
Can I sort of raise a serious cultural state of the nation point? Why is there so much swearing on British television?
Brookie.
And we don't need it. Do we?
this is Stephen Brooke doing his best Miss Marple impression. Yeah.
Mary Whitehouse, I do believe. Yeah, but get over it, guys. Grow up. Yeah.
I think the BBC they've said that they're going to clamp down on some of the worst abuses. Certainly when it's Jonathan Ross, anyway.
Absolutely. Speaking of the BBC, they've appointed their first Muslim head of religion, Akil Ahmed. The Mail has already been having a field day on that, but he's actually been welcomed by Church of England Bishop, I noticed this week. Also, Jonathan Dimbleby wrote in Index on censorship in defence of Jeremy Bowen. And the Evening Standard in London relaunched this week and led to a bit of a spat between former and current editors, didn't it, Stephen?
Yes, it's very rare for a former editor of the publication to get stuck in quite the length and breadth that Veronica Wadley did. This week, in response to a question from Media Guardian, who'd interviewed new editor Georgie Gregg, who has been saying some reasonably disparaging things about the state of the paper under her reign, and then also putting up all these posters saying sorry for
the uselessness of the previous regime.
Yes. Yeah. So she came out really with, I don't know if we say all guns blazing or hands flapping.
She's certainly not happy.
No, and she
very strongly worded.
She said it's basically an insult to the staff and the readers, you know, the loyal readers who stayed with the Standard through the free sheet onslaught. And she then said that this so-called edict for happy news was a bit like a sort of, what was it? It was like a sort of Stalinist show trial.
Yeah, it was like, you know, Pravda, it was turning into Pravda. There were Russian references because, of course, it's now owned by this Russian oligarch.
And but then she slipped in a particularly biting one at Greg, pointing out the history of collaboration old Etonians have had with KGB agents.
Oh, dear. John Plunkett, what about the product itself? We shouldn't spend too much on it. We'll get accused of Metropolitan metropolitan bias, of course, but we should have a word on the design.
The standard is very important.
No, I'm not asking, I'm not talking to you, Brookie. That question was directed at you. Get, I have
back
plenty
in
of,
my box.
Yeah, absolutely. John, what did you make of the...
Let me get a word in lengthways here. Yeah, I was really disappointed because I really want a strong Evening Standard. And I think the new paper, unfortunately, apes many of the worst habits of some of the free sheets. So at least it looks familiar. You know, what a gimmick on your launch day to give it away for free, because that's just what Londoners want, another bloody free paper, you know.
God, I know. And it was rather indistinct with all this, you know, the orange and cyan all over the front. Indistinguishable from the other free sheets.
I was underwhelmed, and I think a point which I know Brookie's going to make, so I think I'll steal his thunder, was that the strapline London's quality newspaper was a very good one, and that was the one thing that differentiated itself, because it was worth 50 pence. I think there's little to differentiate it, certainly from its front page, from its free rivals.
It is time to go. If you want to give your feedback on anything we've discussed, post a comment on the blog, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, or head over to the Facebook wall, or follow our instant updates on Twitter. Matthew Wells, for me, Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.